reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AA Blue Chip speakers desperately in need hear our speaker, and we believe that only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this. Tonight's speaker is a guy that to a lot of us needs no introduction, but I love hearing him tell his story. It's all solution, and I come to these rooms for solution to my problem, not to hear people gripe or tell war stories, but I hope he tells a few of his war stories. And as a side note, this is the man that took me through the steps, and he truly saved my life. And except for my dad, who recently passed away, I would say this man is the most influential man in my life. So with that, I give you Bill.
Good evening, everybody. Tensley, thanks for the kind words. I'm Bill Barnes. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1993. It's great to be back at NABA. The guy that I asked to be my, I guess he was my fourth sponsor, was the guy that I actually worked the steps with. And I'll talk a lot more about sponsorship in a little while, but I'd been in the rooms for a few months, and I'd asked some guys to sponsor me, and I was ready to work steps, and they weren't. So I kept switching, and through the big boy upstairs, I was at a men's workshop called Rock Eagle, and I had known this guy from 10 years earlier, and he came up and tapped on my shoulder, and it was my friend from 10 years ago, and he had 3.5 years sober, long-term sobriety, and that was an eternity to me at the time. So, and he came here. He was a regular here. I think it was the 9:30 everyday meeting here. His name was Lawrence Potts. Unfortunately, he's passed on. But Lawrence was a great guy. I was attracted to him for a number of reasons. One is it was obvious when I looked around at what he was doing, and he was also successful in business, and that was an attraction to me. And so I would come to meetings here to meet with him, and one of the things I remember the most about him is that he had a great sense of humor, and he would always talk solution. But in every time he would share, which was just about every meeting, he would always, even though he had a great sense of humor, he would always say this during his sharing. He would say, you know, this is serious business. And I'll never forget him for that, because this is serious business. Again, we have a great time around here, and one of the things I'll talk about later is learning how to have fun sober. It's a big deal in recovery. A lot of people struggle with it, but the book talks about what it was like, what we did, and what it's like now. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on what it was like, because if you're sitting in this room, you know what it was like. You lived it. So I'm just going to qualify myself a little bit, and then I want to talk a lot about what I've been taught here, which I've been told to call the solution. So I was a late bloomer. I didn't start really drinking until I was 18. I know there are people probably sitting here that can tell their story. They started when they were 5, you know. But I wasn't one of those. And I started, but I made up for lost time. Discovered the typical thing we hear in an alcoholic story, because it's true of most of it. When I discovered my first drinks, I had that warm feeling inside, and I became a part of, I had a community. Later did I come to understand that really was a using community and not a real, true, quality friendship community. But I couldn't see that, because I have a disease called alcoholism. It's a peculiar disease. It's got peculiar thinking involved. Really, I'm going to be brief on this. Over a 20-year period, I was out there from, I burned 3 marriages down, and I ended up, I truly respect the singleness of purpose here, but part of my story is some outside issues, and I will talk about those, and I hope that wouldn't offend anybody. And just my humble opinion is a drug is a drug is a drug. Alcohol is a drug, cocaine is a drug, marijuana is a drug, whatever. And I drank and drugged to change the way I felt. And it worked for some period of time until it didn't. And so over that 20-year period, I look back on this, and we don't see this stuff when we're in the middle of it, but always restless, irritable, and discontent, as the book says. And never felt quite a part of. Didn't know it when I was going through it when I was a young kid and a teenager, because I thought that's just the way everybody was. And turns out it's not. And so when I discovered alcohol at 18, back then it was legal to drink at 18. I wasted no time in catching up. So this was kind of magic. And so as I said earlier, I never felt like I fit in. So when I would find drinking buddies, and later on, I know this AA meeting, and I do respect the singleness of purpose, but outside substances are part of my story, and I'm very grateful for that. And just my personal take on this is, a drug is a drug is a drug. You know, I use whatever I use, alcohol, drugs, whatever, to change the way I feel, and that's kind of the way I look at it. And I'm very grateful that those outside substances came into my life when they did, because they took me down quicker than I might have been taken down if I had just kept drinking Jack Daniels. But I want to be clear, I drank Jack Daniels alcoholically the whole time. So I was going to University of Georgia and was drinking, you know, I identified with people who were like-minded, who liked to get drunk and liked to get high. And so I would find these using buddies, and I would call them my friends, but looking back on it again, I know today that they were not really my healthy friends. They were my using buddies and my drinking buddies. And but that's how I felt somewhat a part of where I had never had before. So for the next 18 to 40, I got here at 40 into recovery. So between 18 and 40, 20 years basically. My disease progressed, and it went through a series of relationships. Isn't it interesting how, as an alcoholic, I will take a hostage, or they'll take me as a hostage, and we will try to make it work, and doesn't work, and move on to the next one. And so my history is, this is one of the things I looked back on, and I went, wow, what amazing coincidence. And so I was married. I burned three marriages down in my alcoholism. And I look back on it, it was I would date somebody a year, think I'd fallen in love with them, marry them, be married for 3 years, get divorced, meet somebody, date them a year, 3 years, divorce, meet somebody, date them a year, married 3 years, divorce. The only difference in the three were the first two, I subconsciously knew that I did not want to, I could not continue to live the lifestyle I wanted to continue living. You know, it doesn't work well in a relationship to be out binging on alcohol and drugs, you know, two weekends or during the week quite often throughout a marriage. So the first two I burned down with my using, and then the first two I left because I knew I could not continue to do what I was doing and stay married. So for those that have been in relationships, as I know you all have, it is way easier to leave somebody than it is to be left. So the first two I left. The third one was a reasonably healthy lady, and after the end of that 3 years, I'd been out one too many times, and she had been to see a counselor, and she came home one day and said, Bill, I've been to see a counselor, and I still love you, but you have killed the in love part I had for you. I'm out of here. So, so I knew I had a problem because, as I'd mentioned, I'd gone to treatment 10 years earlier, but I had no set of tools that this program so freely gives us at all. So I white knuckled it for a week, and then, you know, I've learned about in step 6, 5, 6, and 7, character defects and character qualities, and self-pity was a huge character defect rearing its ugly head. I stayed clean, white-knuckled it for about a week. And then I woke up one day and I said, here's how I viewed my life. And One of the things, the sayings I've really latched onto is that all recovery is a change in perspective. The world out there is not going to change. If I want to be comfortable in my own skin, it's how I view myself and how I view everything else out in the world, and therefore I behave to it. And that's what recovery is really good at doing. So at 1 week of white knuckling, and I woke up one morning, and here's my thought process. Who in the world is ever going to want to marry somebody who's been married three times, who's an alcoholic? So I figured my life is over. So I did what any good, grandiose alcoholic and drug addict did. I grabbed whatever credit card I had, borrowed some money, probably took some money, and got on a plane and went to the Caribbean. And I drank Jack Daniels and shot cocaine for the next 48 days in a row. And remember talking to family and friends occasionally, not family, to friends, you know, saying, life's over, I don't care anymore, you know, I don't care if I die, all that kind of stuff. Well, the miracle was at the end of 48 days, while I was down there, I'll add that I had gotten high one night and jumped over a wall that I thought was down to a jacuzzi area. It wasn't. It was down to a rocks. And I broke my collarbone and punctured my lung and stayed in a sling for two more weeks, wide open, just wide open. Well, as the big boy works and stuff, you know, at the end of 48 days, I could not borrow any more money. I was out of money. And a good alcoholic needs money to keep going, especially when you're in a foreign country. So I didn't do it, but I had not sold my plane ticket home, and I still had it. So I got on the plane, came home, and my family and some friends had moved me out of my condo. And they had this treatment center for me to go to. It's called MAR here in Atlanta. And I think it's a world-class treatment center. It's a nonprofit saved my life. And so I feel very fortunate that I ended up there. And I'm going to talk about treatment centers. There are a lot of people I know who have long-term sobriety that did not go to treatment. And treatment is not a requirement for recovery. It is something I definitely needed. I could not, I don't believe, done it without going. That being said, again, I've seen many people get in here that hadn't gone to treatment, and they hit a bottom sufficient enough, as the book talks about, to take suggestions and to be open-minded and willing, and they get sober. But I needed the extra help, and they sure gave it to me. So treatment centers are there's a big difference between recovery and treatment. They're two totally different things. I was very fortunate that my treatment center required me to go to AA, or else I would not have been exposed to it. And so it's a great place to learn your core issues, and it's a great place to learn how to be in relationship. Part of the model of MAR is the community model, which is they purposely put in the apartments. They'll put a brain surgeon with a house painter, with a plumber, with a insurance executive, and all different age ranges. And one of the fun things we had these Kroger cards where we had buy our food for the week. And so picture a brain surgeon, an insurance guy, a house painter, and a plumber going as a group to Kroger and deciding what the community is going to have for dinner that week. As you can imagine, that was a very interesting dynamic. And that was part of the treatment, to learn how to get along with others and to start to learn how to get out of self. Because I've learned long ago that alcoholism and drug addiction is a self-centered disease. It is all about me. I want what I want, and I want it right now. And so at the Kroger store, it was almost fun at the end of treatment to watch the brand new guy walk into the Kroger store. And, you know, we knew what he was going right for what he wanted, instead of saying, what would everybody else want? So that's a small piece of what MAR did for me. And so if you're new here, and if you do not make it on your own, go get in a good treatment center. And again, there's some good ones. There's some really good ones. So when I was in that treatment center, I got exposed to a meeting called the Log Cabin. It was an actual log cabin up in downtown Norcross. And it was actually a CA meeting, which is Cocaine Anonymous. But just to be clear for people that don't know, CA and AA are exactly the same meetings, exactly the same stuff. You can just talk about whatever drug of choice you have. And so I feel very lucky looking back on that, that or very blessed that, looking back on that, that I got exposed to that meeting, because there are good meetings and there are not so good meetings. There are solution meetings and there are problem meetings. And one of the key parts of getting sober is to stick around long enough to find those good meetings. And then the saying I love is I learned to go to 3 meetings a day. And what that was meant by that is I would go to the 15 minutes before the meeting, 20 minutes before the meeting, and get to know people. I'd go to the meeting and stay 15, 20 minutes after and start those relationships up. And so I started doing that, and I immediately identified with all the people that were there. And CA was a very young organization then, and 3 years was a huge amount of time, but they still were talking. They were talking the deal. So I'll back up a little bit. And when I was in MAR, I think this is when my recovery really started. I'd been there about 45 days. And for those that have been in treatment, they have these things once a week called community meeting, where we had 2 apartments with 5 guys in each apartment. We'd come together in one apartment, sit in circle, and there'd be a council there, and you'd talk about the issues of the community. And it's small stuff as Johnny's stealing my cheese, to Johnny's not making his bed, to some more serious stuff. And that's where we'd learn how to relate to other people and work through these issues. And so for the first 45 days, they would occasionally kind of snipe at me and jump on me, and I didn't like it. And so for a few days before the next community meeting, I was trying to manipulate the hell out of everybody. I was as nice as I knew how to be to every single person there, so that just for one meeting, they wouldn't talk about me. They would jump on somebody else, talk about somebody else. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. We start our community meeting, and y'all know what happened. They started on one side of the room, and every single person started jumping in my stuff, and I'm not hearing a word of it. I'm getting angrier and angrier and angrier. Finally gets around to the counselor. I'm thinking maybe he'll save me. Nope, he jumped right in. I stood up, said F this, walked into my apartment next door, went into my bedroom, pulled my closet open, pulled my suitcase out, threw it on the bed, threw the suitcase open, and said to myself, I don't have anywhere to go, which I'm really grateful for. So I sat out on the stoop until it was over, and this is when my recovery started. I was in enough pain at that point that I pulled each person individually, one at a time, all 9 guys, one at a time on the back stoop, and I said, what am I doing wrong? And the key phrase here is at that moment I became willing to hear what I did not want to hear about me. If you had said before that point in any other earlier time in my life, hey, Bill, you might want to look at you don't tell the truth all the time, or hey, Bill, you might want to look at you don't respect other people's time because you're always late, I would have made it about you. I would have said, why don't you look at your own damn self? For it knows one, it takes one to know one. And I wasn't even capable of looking inside and going, this is a stinger. It doesn't feel good, but are they right? So being willing to hear what I don't want to hear has become a huge part of my recovery. And so amazingly, to me at the time, but not amazingly looking back on it, remember, each one was individually, I would pull them out, and they were all saying basically the same stuff. So they were seeing stuff in me. I call it blind spots, things about myself that I would change if I could see them. They could see them. I could not. And they were all seeing basically the same stuff. So I started making changes based on what they told me, and things immediately started getting better. And I saw the benefit of being willing to hear this stuff. And so the very next week, when we sat down at the community again, I was first raised my hand and said, hey, guys, keep calling me on my stuff. I know it doesn't feel good. I call it zinger. This doesn't feel good, but I see the benefit of it. So please keep doing it. And they did. So, and I became willing, continued to be willing to hear it. And I've tried to stay willing to hear this stuff to this day, because I know my sponsor, Lawrence, would tell me there's nowhere to get to. I'm never going to arrive. It's how do I get a little better at this each day? As the book talks about, this is a one day at a time program. There's nowhere to get to. It's how do I get a little better at it every day? So that's when my recovery started. And then I was serious about this stuff. And I can remember The first few months of recovery, I was on fire for recovery. And I remember this guy one day looking at me and said, he said, "Bill, you know recovery's cool, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, it is." And sure enough, it is. And so I'm going to that treatment center. I then meet Lawrence Potts. I start working the steps, and he walks me through the steps in a quick but thorough way. And Lawrence did it a little differently, and this is the way I've always sponsored guys because this is the way I was taught, and it worked. And the book is real clear about there's more than one way to get sober. There's more than we know only a little, as the book says. And so what Lawrence did was he had me read the big book, but he worked me out of the 12 and 12. The 12 and 12 is a really well-written book by Bill Wilson that breaks each step down individually in a few pages, which was easy for me to comprehend and understand. So we very quickly but thoroughly went through the 12 steps, and I'm forever grateful for that. Unfortunately, Lawrence died a number of years later of cancer, and I really miss him. So part of what Lawrence taught me and what I've kind of gleaned onto through the years is this is a one day at a time program. And so going to meetings for years, I've kind of looked at what does it take to get sober and what does it take to stay sober. And, I kind of, with the help of others, came up with this thing called the six things. And I'll go through them quickly, and then I'm going to break them down and talk about why they're important. And the first thing is go to meetings. Second one's get a competent sponsor. The third one is work all 12 steps. The fourth one is learn how to pray. The fifth one is to work with others. And the sixth one, which was added later, just as important, the other one is to learn how to have fun sober. So going to meetings, this is where I find that fellowship. The fellowship that this is tonight is not the program. It is the fellowship. Fellowship is a magical, wonderful thing. It's where I make relationships, lifelong relationships, where I find a competent sponsor, but it is not the program. As I understand it, the program is the 12 steps. That's where the miracles happen. That's where the change happens. If the old saying, if nothing changes, nothing changes. If I'm just showing up at meetings and listening and not doing any work, then I'm still the same guy I was when I got here. So the steps are where it's at. So I work all 12 steps. And then through that process, I learned how to pray. And I'll talk about the higher power thing here for a minute. I was one of those guys that did not, I was, when I look back on it, alcohol and drugs are my higher power. I was my higher power. I thought I didn't need any of that stuff. And I didn't want to talk about that stuff. In fact, my younger brother, who's just a year younger than I am, has been a senior pastor for 40 years. And you can imagine the conversations he tried to have with me before I got sober, and I wanted to hear none of it. So when I got here, I had all this contempt, as the book says, I had all this contempt prior to investigation. And so, but I kept going to meetings and listening to you guys talk about finding a higher power and what it does for you, and how it's like having a best friend, and it can be a higher power of my own understanding. It doesn't have to be your understanding. And that's one of the magic parts about the meetings and the program itself. Is if I had come into an AA meeting and y'all had said to me, "You have to believe in this, this, or this, or this," I would have been out of there. This is an inclusive program, not an exclusive program. And so y'all let me find my way through to the higher power. So what I did is trying to think logically. I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. What I'm going to do is there was a group of people at my first meeting, the meeting place where I went at the log cabin, who I admired, who I could just tell they were doing the deal. They were sober. They had some clean time. They were not lying to me. They were not stealing. They had relationships. And so I took a number of those guys and I said, okay, they're going to be my higher power. And I kind of set them up here on my left shoulder. And this is how simple the spiritual part of the program is for me. And I know people will complicate the heck out of it, but I try to keep it very simple. So if I want to use a higher power, all I had to do at any time during the day was to, if I'm disturbed for any reason, I could look up and I was getting ready to do something. If I was concerned that it wasn't the right thing or it was a lie or whatever, I just could look up on my left shoulder and go, what would these guys think about what I'm going to say or what I'm going to do? And that makes me tear up a little bit. That gave me the ability to check my thinking and to get some good input on what I was getting ready to say or what I was getting ready to do. And so I started using that, and then through remaining open-minded and willing, I started looking deeper and deeper into where I found what I choose to call God today. And he still sits right up here on my shoulder, and I still talk to him. There's three ways I know to communicate with my higher power. There's prayer, there's meditation, and then my favorite is a conversational relationship. What would you have me do here? You know, I'm gone into the Kroger store, and I'm in the treatment center. I've got $10 to my name. I walk up, hand the $10 to the clerk at the Kroger for a 25-cent pack of gum, and they hand me $20 back in change for that $10. What is my thinking as a young alcoholic drug addict going to be? The insanity of it. It's going to be, yippee, I got some money I didn't have, you know. And I might even be crazy enough to say, God gave this to me. But if I look up and I say, God, should I keep the money or should I give it back? The answer comes like that. Give the money back. So learning how to do that was a practice thing for me and a practice thing. So in that example, as even walking out of the store after I've given the money back, you know, at first I wouldn't have been worried one bit if I kept the money about that clerk, whether they're going to have to make money up. It was all about the self-centeredness of me, of our disease. But even if I gave the money back, walking out of the store, I may still be going, damn, I could have used that money. But a day, a week, a month later, I could look back on that and go, you know, I did the right thing. And I started to build some healthy self-esteem and healthy self-respect based on my behavior. If I want healthy self-esteem, what do I need to do? I need to act esteemably. I need to do the next right thing. I think the people that know me well, when I open my mouth, the truth comes out. And I literally had to learn how to do that. Standing on the front of the log cabin my first month or two, if I was telling a story, instead of going to lunch with Tinsley in Decatur, I would make it. I met the Maharishi, got on a private helicopter, and we went to India for lunch so that you would be impressed by me. And what I came to find is the only people that were impressed by that stuff were other very sick people. And the really healthy ones, all they cared about was, when I open my mouth, does the truth come out? Do they have to worry about that? Do I have a good heart? Do I show up when I say I'm going to? You know, am I a good friend? And so I had to learn that lesson and learn to practice it. And I've learned that long ago. So I had learned kind of an interesting, a fun tool is I put a truth filter right here. Here's my brain. Here's the truth filter, and here's my mouth. So every thought that leaves my brain has to go through the truth filter before it comes out of my mouth. And that is still there, and it's in good form, and it works, and it's wonderful because you know what the people talk about, you know, the truth works just fine. And so I started learning how to do that. So the sixth thing, I've gone to meetings, I've gotten that sponsor, I've worked all 12 steps, I've found a higher power, which is incredibly, it's a spiritual program. It's not a religious program. It's a spiritual program. I've learned to depend on that higher power for that simplicity I just talked about what's the next right thing for me to do or say. And I use that every day. And it's another little filter I put up here is if I'm disturbed, the spiritual axiom is, if I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. It doesn't say, if I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with the person I'm upset with. And what they're saying there is that I'm sitting in some form of character defects, which is, for me, my biggest character defects have always been, I'm way better than I used to be, but still there is impatience and intolerance. If I'm totally patient and totally tolerant with somebody, they're not going to get me. And long ago, somebody taught me the brain cancer theory, which I really like. So whenever, if anybody on this meeting looks back at the last time they were mad at somebody, picture that person in your head, and if you will, and And then if I was to say hypothetically to you, hey, I know that person. Did you know that they've been going to the Emory Hospital here in Atlanta for the last 5 years, every week secretly getting chemotherapy for this big brain tumor in their head? And it was affecting what they said and what they did. And if that was true, how would you feel about them? Would you still be upset with them? And the answer obviously is no, because they can't help it. Well, I believe people living in their character defects is exactly the same thing as having brain cancer. They can't, it's those blind spots I was talking about. They can't see it. They're doing the best they can with what they have to work with. And they have these blind spots. So a number of times in my life, I've never said to somebody when they're acting a little off, I've never said, you got brain cancer. But in my head, I've gone, brain cancer. And what that's given me is the ability to look at them differently. All recovery is a change in perspective. How I look at somebody bears how I respond to them. And the saying I love that I heard in a meeting one time is, in recovery, we learn how to respond with character qualities instead of react with character defects. That's what step six, five, we learn in 5, 6, and 7 is about, is character defects are the problem, character qualities are the solution in every situation I'm in. The only qualifier to that statement is if there's true abuse or true violence involved, which is not part of my life typically. It, whenever I'm disturbed, it's because I'm sitting in a character defect. So, so I found that higher power. I started using him, using regularly. And then I start working with others. And that's been a real gift in my life is getting a chance to work with some guys that want to do the work. And, they show up willing to take suggestions. And I've learned a lot about sponsoring people. And one of the biggest things I've learned is I don't tell anybody what to do. How would I know to tell somebody what to do? My sponsor taught me this, that I'll make a suggestion and sometimes a strong suggestion, but it's not my place to tell you what to do. And so I suggest you go to meetings. I suggest you go get a sponsor, but it's up to you whether you take the action or not. I was taught I'm responsible for my recovery. Nobody else is. If I want what my sponsor has, I need to go to him and ask him to help me. What would you suggest I do next? All right, I've done that. What would you suggest I do now? All right, I've done that. What would you suggest I do now? And a good sponsor is going to be there willing and ready to help. So, so I got that higher power. I start working with others and it is so fun to watch the light come on when somebody's serious about this deal and they show up and they're willing to do those six things. And you watch their life unfold. My sponsor told me early on, he said, Bill, and he was very good at explaining things. He said, Bill, here's one thing I cannot explain to you. If you do the things that are suggested by this program, these cool things will come out of left field and right field as time goes on that you don't expect. And they're really cool. And he was absolutely right. And it's never stopped for me. It just keeps getting better. So I work with others and I become willing to do that. And, you know, and it's not just a magnanimous thing. It is, I do want to help and I do the best I can to try to help, but I benefit. When I'm sitting there talking to somebody about step 6 and 7, character defects, character qualities, who do you think that helps? That helps me remember about character defects and character qualities and to try to move into character qualities in all situations. It's a beautiful thing about this program. We all benefit from helping each other. So I work with others and then learn how to have fun sober. And this is a big deal. Some people come into the program, don't have any trouble with this. There's an amazing number of people who really do struggle with learning how to have fun sober. And the analogy I like to give is like, if Tinsley was saying, and if I called Tinsley up and I said, Tinsley, I need a good meeting on Friday night, on Monday night. I need a speaker meeting on Monday night. And Tinsley said, hey, there's this great meeting at NABA called the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. And here's how you get there. And it's a great meeting. You'll like the folks. Great. Because I'm willing, I would walk through those feelings of how do I get there? Is it going to be a good meeting? Are the people going to be welcoming and friendly? Am I going to hear a good message? Because I'm willing, I walk through all those feelings. I show up to the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting, and Tinsley Ellis is telling a story, and I hear this great story, and I'm going, these people are friendly, and they're all smiling like you are now, and I feel welcome, and I'm willing to come back. But even the second, third, fourth, fifth time, I don't know everybody yet. And I'm still not sure, is it going to be another good speaker? Is it going to be, people are going to be as friendly? And when I start to try to meet people, are they going to be welcoming? And so, but I'm willing. So I walk through all those feelings to keep going. Well, after I've been to this blue chip speaker meeting 10 times, guess what? I'm just looking forward to going to the blue chip speaker meeting because I know it's going to be a good meeting. I get to see some people I've made relationships with and having fun. So it's the same thing with learning how to have fun. If I don't know how to have fun, is figure out what it is I want to do. And if you're struggling with this, ask your friends what they do for fun. Say, hey, can I go do this with you? And be willing to walk through all those feelings of how do you do this and where do you do it? And will you do it with me or can I do it by myself or however? And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money either. It can be stuff that's free. So, but it's, to me, it's incredibly important. In recovery, I'm taught to get out of self. I'm taught to be of service to my wife, to my community, my job, everything else. And if I don't take time at least once a week and preferably more than once a week to go have some fun and fill myself back up, I think that's part of being a healthy human being. I'm going to burn out. I'm going to go, is this all there is? And I'm going to go back out. So, and here, the last thing on this is, you know, it's just more fun to have fun. You know, the book talks about we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I think that's what they're talking about. So those are the six things. Go to meetings, get a competent sponsor, work all 12 steps, learn to pray, work with others, and learn how to have fun sober. So we'll talk a little bit about like what it's like, what life is like now. So I told you I was had that feeling. I divorced for the third time. I burned my business to the ground, faced all kinds of consequences, financial and other consequences. I've never met anybody that came into recovery that danced into the floors and said, I have no consequences. This is going to be great. Everybody I've ever met in recovery has some kind of consequences. And what's amazing about this program is that people will walk us through these consequences. They've been through them. They know how to go through them in a healthy way if I will just reach out and ask. So I got to the program, divorced for the third time, past broke. I wasn't broke. I was past broke. So I'm going to touch on one more topic, and then I'll tell you what life is like now, because this is a big one for me. So I am still in treatment, you know, 8-9 months in. I stayed for a good while because I wanted to make sure I was going to get this thing. But I'd gone back into my career, which was a commission sales guy, and I'm sitting at my desk the second day back, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm feeling the weight of this tens of thousands of dollars that I cannot bankrupt, all this money that I owe to friends and family. I wanted to pay it back, but I had no money to pay it back. So I'm sitting there looking out my window. I've done everything I can do for the first 2 days to get my career back going, but I still can't pay these people back. I'm feeling the weight of all that. So you know what I did? Anybody know? I called my sponsor. So when I'm struggling, I'm supposed to call my sponsor. I'm not supposed to try to figure this out myself and then call him. I called him when I was struggling. It's amazing to me how people sometimes will, when they're being sponsored, try to figure it out and then call them. Here's what I figured out. Instead of just calling my sponsor and saying, I'm struggling with this. What do you have perspective on it? So I called my sponsor and I said, he said, what's going on? I said, all this money out and how I'm going to pay it back. And he went on to explain this tool, which I think is, I call it the second most useful tool in recovery behind prayer. It's called learning how not to project. The definition he taught me was projecting is projecting my thinking into the future or into the past, worrying about something I can do nothing about at this moment. He taught me this. It's a useless, harmful exercise. It has no possibility of making things better and every possibility of making things worse. And what gave me the ability to start looking for this in my thinking was when he said to me, he said, Bill, does you worry about this at this moment have any possibility of getting that money paid back? I said, nope. He says, all it does is make us miserable for no reason. He said, there's a difference between planning and projecting. Planning is a really good thing. If there's something I'm worried about in the future or in the past that I can do something about at this moment, I should do that. And in this example, he said, pull out a piece of paper, write down all the people you owe money to and how much you owe them to, and then prioritize it. Then put it in a drawer. And once you make a commission, then pull it out and start making payments, which is what I did. And over some time, that all went away. So he never told me to overdo anything except this. He said, Bill, take over to this. Human beings are the only animal that can look at what am I thinking? Am I thinking the right thing? Have you ever thought about that? I can look at my thinking and go, am I thinking the right stuff or am I thinking the wrong stuff? And he said, take a look at your thinking and ask yourself the question, are you worried about something in the future or in the past that you can do nothing about at this moment? So I started looking at that train of thought, and I found that 90-something percent of my thinking was way out there or way back here. It was not right here, right now. What can I do to make right here, right now better? And that's been an incredibly useful tool to me. So I hope it helps you. So what my life's like now, from that person that was divorced for the third time, never going to find anybody who would want to be with somebody who burned his business down. I'm 2 years into recovery. I didn't start dating her early. I didn't date her the second week I was there. 2 years into recovery, I'd done a bunch of work on myself, and I met a very happy, very healthy girl named Gigi Barnes. Her now name is Gigi Barnes, and we've been happily married for 25 years now. And that's a miracle of recovery. But one more thing I can tell a story on is, so here's the miracle of what we can walk through. You know, if you think you got consequences, so I'd fallen in love with Gigi, and it was time to go talk to her parents about doing the customary, ask her dad's hand in marriage and talk to her mom and all that stuff. And they knew me a little bit by then and kind of liked me. And so I was able to sit down with them and through that conversation, I said, but I want to marry your daughter. But by the way, I need to let you know I've been married 3 times and I've been through bankruptcy and I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. and believe it or not, they came to love me and been very close with them. Her father's passed now, but her mom's still alive at 98, and had a magic relationship with them for many, many years. So whatever you're walking through, you can walk through it with the help of others and stay honest, and it can work out well. In my business, I started practicing the principles that I learned in this program. And I was in the shopping center business, so we bought shopping centers. And I got to the place where people were giving me millions and millions of dollars to invest in shopping centers. And they trusted me. You know, think of the miracle of that. You can't get where I ended up from where I started. A totally dishonest guy to somebody that people trusted with lots of money. And I treated them like I would want to be treated, and had a very, very successful career. And I was able to retire very comfortably in 2017. And a lot of people made a lot of money because of how I practiced the principles in all of my affairs in my work. So if you're new here or if you're not new here, recovery's cool. And if I do the basics, I didn't cover this and I will now. The basics of recovery, real quickly, is how do I grow my sobriety how do I maintain it and grow it? And I call it the basics of recovery, doing the basics every day. What I do for me is I say the third step prayer on my knees first thing in the morning. It's what a cool prayer it is. Relieve me of the bondage of me, my character defects. Before I do that, I've discovered this thing called the ponderables. And if anybody wants to know what those are, I'll be happy to put them in the chat later if somebody wants it. Somebody in service to AA has compiled a compilation of AA, NA, Native American, and Buddha stuff, these readings. It's about 6 or 7 readings, all recovery related. And he sends it out at 5:30 every morning in an email form. So before I get out of the bed today, I prop myself up. I pull up the ponderables on my email. I read all of them because I don't want to miss those nuggets. I like that term. I hear nuggets in meetings, those things I can grab onto and I can use to better my life. And I read all those, every one of them, because I don't want to miss anything. Then I roll on my knees, say a third step prayer. And the reason I do that is because if I get up and go to the bathroom, go make coffee or whatever I'm going to do, where's my head? My head is already in the day. It's already thinking out in here. But if I do this recovery stuff the very first thing, I'm thinking in a better spiritual way so that when I go into my day, I already have that kind of way of thinking. And then I do the other parts of my basics. I talk to people in recovery every day. Every day. And it's not a chore. I get to do this. And I go to meetings. And then I say the third step. I do a 10th step at night. Didn't take any time after I've learned how to do that. And then I say my third step prayer on my knees again when I go to bed and thank God for keeping me sober. And one additional thing I've learned to say in the morning is a little additional prayer. I say, God, please give me the vision to know what to think, say, do, and feel today. And it kind of gets me going in the right way. So I am as fired up about recovery as I was the first day I got here. And the reason is because there's a payoff to it. There was a payoff to using alcohol and drugs. There's a huge payoff to practicing sobriety. My life is unbelievably good. Things don't always go great or go well, and bad things happen. But the program has given me a set of tools to go through that stuff without ever even thinking about using over it. It's how do I go through this in a healthy way? So thank you for letting me share. Tim, thanks again for asking. Tim Tinsley, thanks for the great introduction. And I love all the smiling faces and hope you all stay sober the rest of the night and stay sober tomorrow. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for the good news, Bill. It was awesome.
That was wonderful, Bill. Thank you so much.
That was Bill, terrific. You're rocking, thank you.
You're rocking as always, buddy. Thanks.
Oh, brother.
My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. I made it 30 days.
Awesome, Jim. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm on 30 days. Woo! Yeah. All right. Yep.
Thank you.
Very cool.
Thank you so much.
Great job, Bill.
A thousand nights.
Good to see you, Bill. Thank you for the story.
Really, always a pleasure.
I always enjoy hearing your story.
Thank you. Thank you.
So great.
Awesome story. Yeah, a lot of good nuggets in that one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think they're great nuggets.
I'll just tell you that if you listen to it again, what you'll hear is a good AA talk. That's the definition of a good AA talk, Bill. You did a great job. Knocked out of the park as usual.
Thank you very much.
Thing I own in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I've lost them day and night. I need someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together. together on that broad highway.